Yo, what's cracking? This your homeboy Ice Cube, and you tuned in to Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. You know what it is, baby.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike with the Mountain Weekly News. Welcome back to episode number 59 of the Everything Snowboarding, Outdoors, and More podcast. This week's podcast is being brought to you by Snow King Mountain Resort. Snow King Mountain Resort, located here in the heart of downtown Jackson, Wyoming, offers steep, deep skiing without the crowds. For more information, check out the King. This week's special guest is Eric Blem. Eric is the author of the new Craig Kelly book that is absolutely stunning. If you have not picked up this book yet, just pause right now, go find a copy, and then come back to this podcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this week's special guest is a famous author, bestseller, Eric Blem, former Transworld editor-in-chief, and honestly, he's here to tell this story about Craig Kelly, the author of the new book. I mean, it is absolutely stunning. Eric, let me just start by saying, you know, The Darkest White, a mountain legend, and the avalanche that took him, the hairs on my arm are standing up right now. This was an amazing, amazing read. It was great to listen to as well on the Kindle. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to write the story of Craig Kelly and kind of the events toward the end of his life that happened.
Dude, I can't. that's amazing. that reaction. And I just, I'm humbled and honored to be here, and so many people have been just taken by the story. And, you know, literally 10 minutes ago, one of the survivors of the avalanche wrote me, who I interviewed, and just gave me her feedback. And it was just very much, she just said that she was actually kind of on edge, and she just said, I think it's going to take me several days to recover from reading about it, because she said, you put me back in that moment. And it was really great. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to give a really raw account of what happened, so people will think a little more, pause maybe in their own situations. But yeah, we can get into that later. But yeah, just kind of interesting how you brought that up off the get-go. And literally like 10 minutes ago, I got an email from one of the survivors who just finished reading the final book.
I mean, it's amazing. Everybody I've spoken to is having a similar reaction. Anybody that's in the snow sports world that hasn't read it, I'm sure they're going to have a similar reaction. And one of the things for me that was really special is this wasn't just a story about Craig and Craig Kelly. This was also a story about the Mount Baker hardcore. And this was also a story about how snowboarding was introduced to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. Totally. And I mean, there's always been the stories and the legends, and I'm not a Pacific Northwest local. I'm an outsider, but I had my questions over the years, and I just wanted to kind of pay homage to some of the people who maybe don't have their names mentioned in the past, and some of the events that a lot of people haven't heard about, and, you know, and tie that all together with Craig's story, which began right then and there as well. And I thought it was interesting to find out just some of those little details of those first runs that he took, for instance, with Dan O'Donnelly and with Jeff Fulton, and also just to even dig back further and figure out how the heck did the first boards show up in the Pacific Northwest? How did those first boards end up in Fulton's Schwinn Cyclery in Mount Vernon, or down the at the Dobus's shop as well, Bike Works? Yeah, it was a detective endeavor, really, to try and piece it all together. And in the end of the day, yeah, I was stoked, because not all stories get in there, and I was hoping it wasn't going to bum some people out. But everybody, even those who were potentially involved or at arm's length from several of the events that occurred, they're all just like, you nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that, I mean, anybody in the Pacific Northwest is going to really, really dive into this. I mean, you're talking about George Dobus and, you know, the old Mount Baker snowboard shop. And you're talking about, you know, I met Fulton when I actually moved up to Mount Baker for a winter. And I met this guy, Fulton, and I just thought, oh, it's just some dude. He works construction, some old guy. People said he used to snowboard type of thing. I had no idea. It wasn't until right now reading this book, I'm like, are you kidding? That's who I was in I was in that guy's presence and his family. And I don't want to ruin the book, but, you know, it's so cool that you, you know, obviously your background, you know, in writing and being an author, I mean, you dug deep. And my question, why now? You know, it's been, over 20 years since Craig left us. Why was the timing now to write this book?
Well, I mean, it took me 5 years to write it in total. For background, when Craig passed away in January 20th in 2003, I wrote a story about to celebrate his life, a tribute to his life, for Transworld Snowboarding Magazine. And I also wrote one for Couloir Magazine and a couple shorter like obituaries for a smaller like Outside Magazine. And I think Ski Show Daily, they wanted me to write something. Because I had traveled with Craig and had connections with those publications. So I became the person they kind of went to and said, hey, you know Craig, right? Yeah, can you write something? So I went to his memorial service. And so really the research started then and there. And also just following the events of the avalanche, you know, waiting, trying, wondering what the heck happened. How did this many people get caught in this avalanche? How did Craig get caught? Because he was so smart. And so that's how long ago it was. But roughly 6 years ago, when it had been about the 15-year anniversary of Craig's death, I was in a lift line. And this kid, probably in his 20s somewhere, looked over and looked down at my board. And I had kept when Craig passed away, there was a kid in Park City who him and his brother made Craig Kelly as my co-pilot stickers. And they had plastered them around and people did it to honor Craig. And I had kept several of those that I had ordered. And even recently someone sent me a few who kept some. This kid looks over at my Craig Kelly as my co-pilot sticker on the nose of my board and just says, "Who's Craig Kelly?" And I just was floored. I really couldn't believe that anybody, a snowboarder especially someone who looked like a snowboarder who knew what they were doing. I mean, his board was chipped up. He rode it hard. This wasn't like a weekend warrior. He was a snowboarder. And he did not know and had no idea who Craig Kelly was. And so I thought, this is, you know, Craig is, I don't think he would ever be forgotten by the people who looked up to him as a hero and a god, really, in the early to mid 80s, into the 90s. But the current generation had no idea. So in a way, he was being forgotten, and one more generation, and that would be the case. And so I thought, this is the time to do it. Let's tell Craig's story. And in the process, I just wanted to tell a bit of the history of snowboarding, as well as, when I went home from that trip, I went to my storage unit, and I looked into an old box that I had kept, and it just said Craig. I wrote the word Craig, underlined it with black, you know, magic marker or whatever, a Sharpie, and pulled it out, and I started looking through everything, and that's when, honestly, all the questions came back to me, like, wow, you know, I still never was really clear. I was never really okay with, you know, the answers to what happened that day. There's got to be more to this story. And so that's when I contacted Gillian Kelly, Craig's sister, via Facebook, and who was, you know, Craig's mentor in guiding towards the end of his life. And I just asked a few people who were close to him, and ultimately Craig's dad, Pat, and his brother, Brian, and everybody was kind of, and Sabina, of course, and Olivia as well, are you okay with this? And they were all just like, you know, yeah, they got behind it and wanted me to go for it.
You know, I've had a similar experience where I have on the dash of my old Ford Bronco, the Craig Kelly as my co-pilot sticker, and had a younger kind of up and coming professional snowboarder, sponsored rider get in the car. And he said, "Who's Craig Kelly?" And
no way.
And I said, "Really?" But I realized, I was like, oh, this has been, you know, he wasn't alive when Craig Kelly was alive. And so It's really important, because even the stories of, you know, the Marco Savaretti and, you know, I mean, Stephen Koch is still alive, but a lot of these, like the big mountain guys that kind of pioneered this, they've long been forgotten. You know, like people kind of know about Jeremy Jones now because of what he did and Jones Snowboards, and he's the face. And, you know, the current generation knows of Travis Rice, but you pull back 10, 15, 20 years, it's really easy. And I think this has happened, you know, in skateboarding and surfing as well, where it's kind of easy just to forget about the people that were kind of the pioneers, the ones that really led us into this. And I mean, I can't thank you enough for bringing Craig's story and, you know, the story of Craig Kelly back to life. You know, it's interesting. I talk to Rankwood a lot, and I talk to friends that are from the Mount Baker hardcore in the Northwest. And they mention, you know, when they talk about Craig, they use the word Craig. I mean, they're talking about it like it's their friend. And it's, you know, to me, it's like, I never got to meet Craig Kelly. It's this like legendary person and kind of the path that I had gone on myself. You know, I ended up taking all my Avi courses, and I did my Avi 1 and Avi 2, and then I did my Avi 3, and I became really big into splitboarding, and like that has kind of become my path. You know, like the days of competing in the contest or even the big mountain stuff, like that's just that has really disappeared. And like for me, just the love of going outdoors, and you know, I went for a long tour yesterday. I mean, work is just absolutely crazy, and to be out there, I was like so peaceful, and I was like, oh my gosh, like this is why. And actually I had the book on the Kindle, and while I was out there, I was listening to some of the episodes, just being like, you know, or the chapters, just being like, you know, there's so many similarities between Craig and the lifestyle that he lived and the lifestyle that myself and people that listen to this podcast, that yourself, you know, all these people that were touched by the mountains and said, you know what, like I'm going to make a go at this. And, you know, I love how you talk about kind of, you know, again, we think of Craig Kelly as just this guy that's always been snowboarding. And you were actually one of the first people or the first person to ever show Craig a splitboard. Is that correct?
You know, I am almost positive. Again, I don't, you know, I couldn't ask him, but, and he's at that time. I mean, it was December 1995. I know the date and the year because that's when I took my level one course. And that's where he showed up and hung out for a few days at Island Lake Lodge. And I was doing this story. It was a chameleon, but it's where I was going and infiltrating the ski area that don't allow snowboarding on a splitboard. And I would ride up the lift as a skier. I'd buy a lift ticket, and then I would surreptitiously put the board together in the trees or somewhere above the most crowded runs at all the different areas that didn't allow snowboarding at the time. And then I would just ride down the center, and I'd keep doing it. And at the bottom, I would just ride in plain sight, turn it back into skis, get back in a lift line until I either got kicked off or tackled by the ski patrol. And so anyways, that was, we talk about that later, but that I had that board with me. It was called the Nitro Tour. I still have it, and it's a really heavy board. It was the first productions, as far as I know, production split board. And I had gotten it, actually the year before, and I'd done those trips the winter before as well. This was December, so it was the winter of 95, 96. So I got it winter of 94, 95. And yeah, he just basically saw it, leaned up against my bedroom when we were trading books, and he like checked it out. He's like, what in the hell is that thing? But Craig is the type of person who his job with Burton and everything was always looking at gear. So if he knew what it was, he might have just said like, hey, tell me about this thing. Like I was with him at times when I would see him on the hill, and he'd know full well that this kid doesn't know who he is. He's covered with a face mask. He's got goggles on, and he's riding a Burton. He would say, dude, what kind of board is that? How do you like those bindings? You know, and so he would do this type of thing because he wanted to get an honest reaction from somebody. So he might have known what it was, but his reaction to me, so we could sit there and check it out, was, dude, what is that thing? And then he totally checked it out. And I'm not going to give it away, but his comment at the end of that little, his first encounter, what I think is his first encounter with the splitboard, was pretty funny. And yeah, right?
Totally. And so, you know, with, you know, I don't want to give away too much of the book. I want to fast forward to kind of Craig's later part in life. You know, Craig had kind of walked away from the professional snowboard industry, you know, no longer was interested in competing, had gotten a taste of splitboarding, had gotten a taste of, you know, that snow up at Whitewater and all through, you know, Baldface and just all the Kootenays. And really, you know, I think he was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Realized, okay, now it's time to start getting the avalanche education, was, you know, going through all the different courses. Then he finds himself up at SWS as a tail guide or working under Rudy as kind of a like an internship or basically like a test run just to give him some time to be in the mountains.
Yeah, no, he was it was his practicum. It was at Selkirk Mountain Experience SME, and he was still trying getting ready to take his assistant ski guide exam in, I believe it was scheduled for February 9th. And so he went up there the first week in January. Rudy actually had two different weeks available for him to come up, and he had to pick one of two. Well, the second one that he had available was the same time that would have conflicted with him taking the assistant ski guide exam. And so fatefully, he took the one that he went on, and he was basically going to part of the ACMG, Association of Canadian Mountain Guides, their suggestions, it's not mandatory, but they suggest, going on a practicum or internship at an area that you're not familiar with a guide that you're not familiar with, and in terrain that you're not familiar with, because that's what you're trying to learn. You're trying to expand your horizons in the mountains. And he had, did his research and honed in on Rudy Beglin or SME, because again, without going too deep into all the details, but he did his research and he found out that a person that he really respected suggested, hey, there's no better place for to have an internship or practicum than there, for those reasons, for the terrain, for the area. And he was warned. He said, this is a, Swiss mountain guide. He's been in Canada for a long time. This is a touring operation, and he's not going to feather your ego. It's going to be tough. You're going to have some tough debriefs. He can be, a tough guy to work for, because he has a great passion for teaching, this guy said, that told him. He said, very much a passion. He's going to make you watch him and learn from him. He's not going to sit there and show you and hold your hand. And this was kind of the reputation that Rudy Beglinger had. He was that guy, and everybody knew it. And Craig did as well, and he went there and was going to learn from someone who he respected by reputation.
And, I've yet to go up there and experience the operation, but for my IV3 course, we did a report on the accident, and that was kind of our final exam to really dive into everything that had happened. And, this is not a CAT operation. This is not a heli operation. I mean, this is a touring operation. And I mean, it's a touring operation where, you mentioned in the book, a group doing, 1,200 feet an hour type of thing. And, usually here in the Tetons, we say, if you're going 1,000 feet an hour, that's a good pace. Yeah. 1,200, this is very high level. I mean, this is, we're climbing, you take a sip and a crumb, like they're not babying you by any means. Yeah. And you actually have gone up there. What was your experience like? I mean, did you feel like, holy cow, like I'm kind of getting my butt kicked here going out on the tours with these guys?
Yeah, I have been there. I felt that was really important to go to the place to where Craig, ultimately passed, and to experience where he made his final turns, and to also understand how the operation works, so it could better help me understand when I spoke to the survivors and, piece together what happened, that it would, you kind of had to go there.
Do you feel that anybody has taken ownership for what happened on that day? Or the days leading up to it?
As a journalist and as a person who tries to keep himself out of the story, I really carefully laid it out in the book. And I, maybe in a year after the book's been out and people have had their own opinions, I'll let them, I might weigh in on that. But I think that when people read the book and read all the thought processes that were going on, I was very careful to lay that out, right? And show what was going on in Rudy's mind, what was going on in Ken Wiley's mind, what was going on in the guest's mind at the time as best I could, and piece it all together that way. So I'd rather not comment on that, because I want people to make their own decision. I think that's fair for all those involved. But I do think that by reading the book and getting that full, you get what was never really told before. Even though there was a coroner's report, there was an independent investigation of the report, nobody was ever able to talk to almost all the survivors and piece it together like I have. So again, I'm not trying to sell the book per se, but I don't want to spoil it for people who do want to read it.
For sure. And I think the one thing that people can really learn from this book is the human factor. Now in avalanche courses, I think in the past we taught, how to kind of stay out of, avalanches, or what to do if you get an avalanche. Now it's like, what about the human factor? How about we figure out a way that we can have discussions before we even get into that kind of terrain, and for people to be willing to
willing to
speak up. And I think that, as you know, that's one of the things in the book. And when I did the report, there were so many times I was like, gosh, I wish somebody had just said something, or I wish somebody had just been a little bit more vocal. When I ski with people here in the Tetons, I do a lot of guiding with friends and people that come into town. And first thing I tell them when we put our split boards on or they put their skis on, I said, look, if there's anything today that you do that makes me uncomfortable, I'm going to say something. And I'm probably not going to be nice about it. Like, I'm just, and I need you as well. Even though I'm leading this group, if you feel uncomfortable at any time, I need you to speak up. And honestly, out of all the people in the years that I've taken in the mountains, I've only had two people ever willing to speak up. And they both were ex-girlfriends, and they both had been ski patrollers. And one was up at Mount Baker, and she was just like, we're not skiing this line. And I said, no, 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 it's good. She said, we're not skiing. I'm not skiing that with you. And that's, you know, it's really interesting, you know, just that human factor. And so I hope that when people are reading the book, it's like, yeah, I mean, like, you know, again, it's really easy to armchair quarterback, but the way that you laid it out, it was just like, here's the facts, and here's, you know, here's the facts from the people. And you also mentioned that, you know, in trauma and things like this, it's easy to maybe forget things. Or even if it's right after the incident happened. And I think that's why a lot of times they do those incident debriefs now, because, you know, it would be really easy just to, gosh, like, did I hear that? Did that person really say that? Like, oh, yeah, there's just so many emotions and so much tied into it.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, I think that what I tried to do as much as I could in the report in the book, as I feel like, you know, to honor Craig. He was such so cerebral. He was an engineer's mentality. He would have reverse engineered this whole thing, I believe, had he heard about it. And when he was doing his studying, he would look at other accident reports. And I was told by Buffery and Lee Usher, a couple of guides that he had worked with at Baldface and all around the world, actually. And they said that Craig always had empathy when he looked at it. And in the book, I think that you can't read the book and look at the two guides involved in this particular incident and not have some empathy for both of them. And that never happened before. I mean, there was zero empathy for Rudy Begliner in Ken Wiley's book, Buried. It was, you know, granted it was a memoir, so it was his perspective. I just wanted to give a full empathetic look. So when people looked at it, and what I've heard so far is they say, wow, what makes it so hard, that human factor, is that you really can kind of relate to both of them. If you look at the situation, you could relate. I'm not going to say you agreed, but you can relate and you can understand a little bit better. And in my mind, that's really important, when, especially if you want to have some learning afterwards. You know, there's a lot of anger in certain situations by certain people, and they'll never change their opinion of what happened. But I think the average person that I've spoken to thus far, including the survivors who were there, they just said, yeah, you did a good job of trying to just lay it out there as objectively as possible. And I hope that that is something that comes from the book. And also for people who read it, that, you know, there's always empathy. Craig always would say, when he would look at these reports, like, well, I don't have a quote from him directly, but Buffery told me that he would kind of, again, empathetically understand, like, he wouldn't just say, oh, why were those people there? Or what idiots were they? What were they doing there? Or why didn't they do this? He would look at it and say, gosh, you know, I can kind of see how that could happen. Not in all cases, but, you know, in certain situations. So I think that it's a good way to look at anything. You can always find fault in something in the past. You can always pick apart anything. God knows there's going to be people who pick apart this book. Once it's written, it's kind of like an avalanche. You can tear it apart if you want. And, or any sort of disaster. In hindsight, you can always find the chinks in the armor. But again, I did my best.
I like that you didn't take sides as well, and kind of, you know, just laid it out, you know. And even though, you know, you had a close relationship with Craig, you know, I went into the book reading, like, I was ready to just, you know, F Rudy. And then just reading it, I was like, oh, wow, I forgot that there's a human side to this. And
yeah, there is. And after both Rudy and to Ken, and I just, again, tried to just lay it out there. And, you know, it's tough. And because you know that you're going to, you know, open up old wounds potentially, but I still think it's never too late to learn. And, you know, the truth will set you free. And there are people who have known things for many years that have just kind of hung on it for a long time. And some of that stuff comes out in the book. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for healing for those involved. And I think it's a good thing for people who want to learn by reading and being an outsider, a voyeur looking in on someone else's tragedy. You know, you can learn from that.
And, you know, being somebody that's been in the industry for as long as yourself and, you know, living this lifestyle and, you know, still shredding and surfing and everything, how do you think that Craig's death affected the snowboard industry as a whole, and specifically splitboarding and backcountry snowboarding? You know, I think probably had just gotten my first split around that time. But I mean, stuff was very antiquated. We were cutting boards in half and, you know, the Volley hard plates with, you know, bindings on top of them. I mean, it was very ghetto. But yeah, was there a group of people, and was there, as the industry as a whole, did the industry kind of say, okay, hold on, we need to like back off this backcountry thing a little bit? Because it seemed like we were poised to really tap into something big. And then it took another 15, 20 years, 10 years for us to get back to that again.
Yeah, no, totally. I think, you know, there's a really good article in Backcountry magazine a couple of years ago. I think Drew Ziff did it on like the history of slipboarding. And, you know, there was people before Craig and kind of the original slipboarders who were doing it out of necessity, like John Buffery made his first slipboard, and Cowboy in Utah, and whoever it was that did the Volley, I'm forgetting names. I so apologize. I don't know that exact specific history. But Dave Downing was really leading the charge in with Burton. But Craig's death was it was like at the time, I feel like one of the darkest days in snowboarding history. So many people had looked up to him at younger ages as, you know, in the first kind of the first wave of snowboarders. So people looked up to him, and if he got into something, they generally, it made them look up, like, I'm gonna pay attention to what Craig's doing. And I think Craig, because of that stature, had what it took that could have taken splitboarding into that next zone right then and there. And it would have kept going because that was his passion at the time. I mean, he thought it was like the Swiss Army knife of free riding to help you places that maybe even a snowmobile won't get to, obviously not a helicopter, but he would also, you know, he was also at that place in life where he was into enjoying nature, not only just for riding down, but also the experience going up and getting out and on, you know, on the approach and everything else. So anyways, I don't know if that really quite answers your question, but I think if I look back at I really feel like splitboard guiding would have progressed a lot faster had this not occurred and had Craig been there. And so many people have said, gosh, Craig would have been such a great guide by looking at all of his, you know, personality traits and what he was doing on the splitboard. That was really a tragedy, and that all the people who could have been guided by him, because he was at that place in his life as a new father where he was into sharing things, where for many, many years, as you learn in the book, he admits, I was selfish, you know, it was all about me and getting powder. So if you compound all that together, where he was, what he wanted to do as a guide, and with the sport, especially with his engineering mindset.
And then, so to date, I mean, there's only been a handful of splitboarders that have gone down the path that Craig was trying to do. Is that correct?
There's quite a few, actually, believe it or not. I mean, there is a ACMG. There's not as many in the ACMG as the CSGA, the Canadian Ski Guide Association, you know, more mechanized. But no, there's been, you know, there are dozens for sure.
There are dozens. Okay.
Yeah, there are dozens. And if you look at, you know, again, the CSGA, you know, possibly more so there. I don't have exact numbers as far as that goes, but there definitely are those. And, he, you know, Craig, if they set up a scholarship fund for people endeavoring to become guides or, you know, avalanche forecasters, professionals, anybody on a snowboard who was going to go down that path and needed help financially. There's a, you know, a foundation that was set up by Savina at her bequest, who actually, Jake Burton Carpenter actually was one who said, you know, people are going to want to do something. They're going to want to donate. You know, people say in lieu of flowers, send this. I said, that's how people help, are able to grieve as well. They're going to want to help somehow. What should we do? And that's when they created that.
Wow. I mean, this is just absolutely incredible, Eric. I mean, you've obviously, you know, you're writing this from the heart. You researched it. You know, as you just mentioned, you know, Craig would have been such a great guide, you know, for not only being the teacher, but also the joker. And, you know, I think for people that didn't know Craig personally, I've heard these stories about how he was such a character. And I mean, a practical joker, somebody that, you know, really, and you talk about this in the book. I mean, you add this element, this human element to him. You know, again, it's easy to kind of put him on a pedestal and this face of snowboarding and, you know, that perfect turn and, oh, look at that, you know, heel side carve and whatever, the toe side. I mean, it's like, that's Craig Kelly. But to hear, you know, the Craig Kelly as the father, and to hear the Craig Kelly that, you know, said, hey, you know, I used to be selfish and like now I, you know, maybe I don't need to go jump off that cliff type of thing. I mean, it just full circle. And it's something that probably everybody that's listening to this podcast is going to go through or already has gone through.
Yeah, no, totally. I never had, how old are you, by the way?
43.
You're 43. Okay, so you are at that age where, you know, it's funny because people who are under 40 are the ones who really maybe have not heard of Craig Kelly. And unless they have a parent or whatever, it's kind of like, you know, I think in war stories, for instance, like if you're a family member who served in the military or whatever, you're going to know who Audie Murphy was from the World War II era, but other people might not know who he is. And same thing for people who are not involved or they don't have parents who are maybe involved in that first wave after, you know, 40 years old or so right now, tend to know who Craig was, and those younger, they just don't. And it's just interesting how that line is kind of drawn. Unless, you know, you're in a place where maybe the Pacific Northwest, where you really are in Craig Kelly country, so to speak. Anyway, I just diverted there from your question and your comment. But yeah, it's cool. And I really did want to try and find some areas of people, newness that people maybe didn't know about Craig. And yeah, so that's where some of those things came from, really just my desire to find bits and pieces that people can't find online about Craig. There are some amazing, great, funny stories like the prankster that you can learn about online if you look up Craig. But I tried to focus on some things that maybe you can't find, and especially the latter part of his life and that whole period of time when he was learning to become a guide. And of course, reconstructing, or I should say deconstructing, reverse engineering the avalanche. Those are the things that really aren't readily available, even for the hardcore Craig Kelly fan. You know, it wasn't there. So I wanted to make sure I gave plenty of pages to that.
Yeah, no, there's so much that I learned about it. I mean, I didn't even know that, you know, the awards that they used to give out were called the Tranny Awards. And I thought that was so great. Like, I hope Rankwit's listening. Rankwit was going to call in. I don't know where he's at. But, you know, it's like, this is great. I mean, you wrote it. Like, your background from Transworld and your background as a snowboarder, like, I was like, wow, the slang and the words that are in here. I'm like, this guy really knows what he's talking about. It sounded like I was sitting there just talking to you and having a conversation as I was reading the book and as I was listening to it. And it's just, I mean, everybody that's listening to this podcast, do yourself a favor, go out and get the book, get the Kindle, however you want to digest it. Eric, where's the easiest way, or how do you recommend for people to not only get the book, but then to kind of follow along with you and maybe look at some of the other books that you've written over the years?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, ericblem.com is a mission control for me. I'm, you know, again, I'm a little bit older. I'm 55, right? So I don't have a massive thing in Instagram, but I'm trying. So Instagram, Eric Blem Official, at Eric Blem Official. Same thing. I think it's Official Eric Blem or Real Eric Blem on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on what was Twitter is now X. So all those places, social media wise, I'm doing my best. I'm trying to get into that world a little bit before I go into my next cave and write my next book. I'll disappear again for a while. As far as a book, it's available everywhere books are sold. And I always like to just make this pitch, you know, since my first book, which was called The Last Season in 2006, which was about a backcountry ranger who went missing in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. At that time, there were so many. I had the list of all the independent bookstores, and I went back and reviewed that list and talked to my publisher. Hey, I want to send letters to these bookstores and tell them about The Darkest White. And I came to find out that, like, there's only about not even a third of them remaining. So a lot of the independent bookstores have disappeared. And so I would just say, if you know, everybody, it's easy to shop on Amazon and online, but just spread it around a little. If you have a bookstore in your town that you like to walk the aisles, and you know, if they have a coffee house, go in there and grab a coffee or a tea and walk the aisles and look at nice books, you know, support them. Get it wherever, you know, Audible is available for those who want to listen to it. And it's a totally different experience. And I'm really happy with that version. And the electronic books for you guys that are into the tablets and reading it on a screen. It's pretty much, you can't not find it. So anywhere is great for me. And yeah, I just, I'm really stoked that it's gotten this kind of a reaction and got a great, amazing, actually just today, the Wall Street Journal did an amazing review. It had a great review in the New York Times, which is really tough to get. And Outside Magazine and all of the snowboarding publications have written something about it or are planning to. So yeah, I just am thrilled with the feedback so far. And really at the end of the day, my goal was to make sure that 2024, at the end of 2024, at least every snowboarder on the planet has heard of Craig Kelly. And hopefully everybody in the world, you know, it's not a book just for snowboarders. It's a book for skiers. It's a book for anybody. I mean, Tony Hawk wrote on the back that it's a book for anybody interested in, you know, the story of an unlikely hero. And that was Craig Kelly. You know, he was a latchkey kid of divorced parents from little Mount Vernon, Washington. And he ended up getting catapulted around the world multiple times and helped to, you know, found a sport and become that sport's ambassador and champion. And ultimately left all that fame and fortune to return to the roots of why he did it in the first place. And that was just to go out and free ride because for one reason, it made him feel good.
Man, it's such a touching story. And I hope that those Craig Kelly is my co-pilot stickers start making a second run. You know, it seems like now would kind of be a good time for those kids to print off a couple thousand and start passing those off. And if not, yeah, I mean, go online and see if I can't find some, because I'm like, you know.
No, you can find him. You'll find the kid's name. If you look up Craig Kelly is my co-pilot, he has a website. And you see his name and it's on there and you'll learn the whole story. I hope he makes them as well. He's honored, I think, when people make their own. I made one out of duct tape with like little stenciled letters and put it on my Jones Stratos not too long ago. And I just have a handwritten Craig Kelly and Black Magic marker on this reissue of Craig's Burton, the Screaming Tree board that I recently wrote a little bit. I try and just put a little, you know, little something like that on all of them. And it's a pretty cool thing. And I hope that people when people say Craig Kelly, I want people to know. When I tell people who don't know about this sport and don't know who Craig Kelly was, and they can't quite grasp how big he was, I tell them, imagine being into basketball, you go to a pickup game somewhere and you walk up wearing a Michael Jordan jersey. And some kid, 20-year-old kid, looks over at you and says, "Hey, who's Michael Jordan?" I mean, I know it's a much bigger world and, you know, the world of basketball and the world in general, but in our world, that's how big Craig was. He was that huge. And I hope other people, you know, learn about him and his legacy and are inspired by the way he lived his life.
Well, Eric, I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast. You sound like somebody I'd love to make some turns with. So if you're ever out in the Jackson area, next time you come out this way, definitely hit me up. And I'd love to do some touring around the backcountry and go find some powder. And yeah, for everyone else out there, I hope you can definitely get a copy of this book or the Audible and go out there, you know, the next time you're touring and just maybe make a turn for Craig or just kind of think about Craig Kelly. Ooh. You know, yesterday I did that and all of a sudden I had this like eagle soaring above me. Like, rah! I was like, holy cow. It's like, it's that palatable. Like, really? Like, so it's.
And that stokes me out. I would love to make some turns with you. This book tour launch, I've been traveling around and I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but I have had powder days and or some of the best days in all the other, you know, some places we're having a pretty tough winter. And then I've shown up on this tour and all of a sudden, you know, it's, you know, 22 inches. I've skied Vail and Beaver Creek and it had not snowed in quite a while. And I got like, you know, 12 inches overnight and just got back from Fernie in BC. And, you know, it had been dumping for several days and we got some great side country powder and lots of powder on the edges. It was just, it's been just awesome all the way around. And I think that's in the spirit of Craig Kelly. and well.
I'm fully grinning ear to ear, smiling, knowing that Craig is stoking you on just these massive powder days, especially when it hasn't been snowing and you're just showing up like, all right, book tour, bam, powder day. Like there's no coincidences in life, especially when it's...
Well, I'll tell you what, the book was supposed to launch in like early to mid-January, but because I was late, it actually launched end of February. And had it been that period of time when the book launched, it would have been, you know, Dust on Crust and Groomers.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Eric. Again, everybody, The Darkest White, a mountain legend, and the avalanche that took him. Very, very good read. It's emotional. You know, I ended up reading it, I think, two sittings, and then re-listened to it on the Kindle, the podcast, and just was like, oh my God. I mean, it's something I'm going to be proud to have on my bookshelf and make sure that everybody that I know that's a snowboarder and especially all the new kids, you know, the new people to town. It's like, here you go. You know, you've got your temper, your avalanche handbook. You've got all these, you know, your mountain guidebooks, like, add this one to your collection because it truly it's a history of snowboarding. It's a history of the backcountry. And then for anybody that starts to get into avalanche education, you know, that snow science component and the way that you talked about it toward the end, I mean, it's just brilliant. So Eric, I really appreciate it.
Rad. No, thanks for having me. And I can't wait to make some turns someday. And thanks everybody who's listening, you know, long live Craig Kelly. Craig Kelly, rest in peace.
Right on. Thanks again, Eric. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
All right, well, that wraps up this episode number 59 of the Everything Snowboarding Outdoors and More podcast. That was such a rad interview with Eric. I hope that you listened to this entire thing. Be sure to pass this podcast on to the people that you know and love in the snow sports world, and make sure they get a copy of Darkest White, a mountain legend, and the avalanche that took him. If you're interested in Craig Kelly, if you're interested in the Mount Baker hardcore, and really the history of how snowboarding was introduced to the Pacific Northwest, wow. This episode is sponsored by Snow King Mountain Resort. Snow King Mountain Resort, located here in the heart of downtown Jackson, Wyoming. Once again, if you're interested in the steep and deep, sick of the crowds, be sure to check out the King.